all below the poverty line. Roughly 13% of Americans are poor, which is no better than we were doing in the 1970s. The poverty rate rose steadily throughout the 1980s and then drifted down in the 1990s. The overall poverty rate disguises some figures that would otherwise leap off the page. Roughly 1 in 5 American children is poor, as are nearly 35% of black children. Our only resounding success is poverty among the elderly, which has fallen from 30% in the 1960s to below 10%, largely as the result of Social Security. Income inequality. We care about the size of the pie. We also care about how it's sliced. Economists have a tool that collapses income inequality into a single number, the Gini index. To derive the Gini index, the personal incomes in a country are arranged in ascending order. A line, the Lorentz curve, plots the cumulative share of personal income against the cumulative share of population. Total equality would be a 45-degree line. The Gini coefficient is the ratio of the area between the diagonal and the Lorentz curve to the total area under the diagonal. On this scale, a score of 0 represents total equality, a state in which every worker earns exactly the same. At the other end, a score of 100 represents total inequality, a state in which all income is earned by one individual. The countries of the world can be arrayed along this continuum. In 2007, the United States had a Gini index of 45, compared to 28 for France, 23 for Sweden, and 57 for Brazil. By this measure, the United States has grown more unequal over the past several decades. America's Gini coefficient was 36.5 in 1980 and 37.9 in 1950. Size of government. If we're going to complain about big government, we ought to at least know how big that government is. One relatively simple measure of the size of government is the ratio of all government spending, local, state, and federal, to GDP. Government spending in America has historically been around 30% of GDP, which is low by the standards of the developed world. It's climbing right now, both because the stimulus is driving up government spending, the numerator, and because GDP has been shrinking, the denominator. Government spending in Britain is roughly 40% of GDP. In Japan, it's over 45%. In France and Sweden, it's more than 50%. On the other hand, America is the only developed country in which the government does not pay for the bulk of health care services. Our government is smaller, but we get less, too. Budget deficit surplus. The concept is simple enough. A budget deficit occurs when the government spends more than it collects in revenues, and a surplus is the opposite. The more interesting question is whether either of these things is good or bad. Unlike accountants, economists are not sticklers for balanced budgets. Rather, the prescription is more likely to be that governments should run modest surpluses in good times and modest deficits in tough times. The budget need only balance in the long run. Here's why. If the economy slips into recession, then tax revenues will fall, and spending on programs such as unemployment insurance will rise. This is likely to lead to a deficit. It's also likely to help the economy recover. Raising taxes or cutting spending during a recession will almost certainly make it worse. Herbert Hoover's insistence on balancing the budget in the face of the Great Depression is considered to be one of the great fiscal follies of all time. In good times, the opposite is true. Tax revenues will rise, and some kinds of spending will fall, leading to a surplus, as we saw in the late 1990s. We also saw how quickly it disappeared when the economy turned south. Anyway, there's nothing wrong with modest deficits and surpluses, as long as they coincide with the business cycle. Let me offer two caveats, however. First, if a government runs a deficit, then it must make up the difference by borrowing money. In the case of the United States, we issue treasury bonds. The national debt is the accumulation of deficits. Beginning around 2001, the United States has been consistently spending more than we take in. It adds up. The U.S. national debt has climbed from a recent low of 33% of GDP in 2001 to a projected 68% of GDP by 2019. If the debt becomes large enough, investors may begin to balk at the prospect of lending the government more money. Second, there's a finite amount of capital in the world. The more the government borrows, the less that leaves for the rest of us. Large budget deficits can crowd out private investment by raising real interest rates. As America's large budget deficits began to disappear temporarily during the 1990s, one profoundly beneficial effect was a fall in long-term real interest rates, making it cheaper for all of us to borrow. Current account surplus deficit. The U.S. current account deficit in 2008 was around $700 billion. Is it time to rush to the supermarket to stock up on canned goods and bottled water? Maybe. The current account balance, which can be in surplus or deficit, reflects the difference between the income that we earn from the rest of the world and the income that they earn from us. The bulk of that income comes from trade in goods and services. Thus, our balance of trade, which, again, can be in surplus or deficit, is the largest component of the current account. If we're running a trade deficit with the rest of the world, then we'll almost always be running a current account deficit, too. For the purists, the U.S. current account would also include dividends paid to Americans who own foreign stocks, remittances sent home by Americans working overseas, and other sources of income earned abroad. When the current account is in deficit, as ours is now, it's usually because a country is not exporting enough to pay for all of its imports. In other words, if we export $50 billion of goods and import $100 billion, our trading partners are going to want something in exchange for that other $50 billion worth of stuff. We can pay them out of our savings. We can borrow from them to finance the gap. Or we can sell them some of our assets, such as stocks and bonds. As a nation, we're consuming more than we're producing, and we have to pay for the difference somehow. Oddly, this can be a good thing, a bad thing, or somewhere in between. For the first century of America's existence, we ran large current account deficits. We borrowed heavily from abroad so that we could import goods and services to build up our industrial capacity. That was a good thing. Indeed, a current account deficit can be a sign of strength as money pours into countries that show a promising potential for future growth. If, on the other hand, a country is simply importing more than it exports without making investments that will raise future output, then there's a problem. Just as you might have a problem if you squandered $100,000 in student loans without getting a degree. You now have to pay back what you borrowed, plus interest. But you've done nothing to raise your future income. The only way to pay back your debt will be to cut back on your future consumption, which is a painful process. Countries that run large current account deficits are not necessarily in financial trouble. On the other hand, countries that have gotten themselves into financial trouble are usually running large current account deficits. National savings. We all tuck money away for our individual needs, college, retirement, etc. Businesses save money too, by retaining profits rather than paying them out to the owners of the firm. Those private savings decisions, along with the government's decision to run a deficit or surplus, have a profound impact on our economy. The simple reason is that savings are necessary to finance investment, and investment is what makes us more productive as a society. If you put 10% of your income in the bank, then somewhere else in the country that money will end up building a plant or financing a college education. If Americans do not collectively put savings in the bank, then we must either forego important investments or borrow from abroad. Again, this assumes that foreign investors are willing to lend at a reasonable rate, which may not be the case for an economy in a precarious state. Over time, countries' investment rates show a striking correlation with their domestic savings rates. The U.S. national savings rate tells a cautionary tale. Personal saving fell steadily from over 9% in the 1960s and 1970s to 6% in the 1980s to below 5% in the mid-1990s to roughly zero by the end of the 1990s. When the recession hit in 2007, the personal savings rate started to climb again. Governments, Washington, D.C. and the states, have been running deficits or dissaving. U.S. businesses were the only ones setting any money aside until households were shocked into saving by the recession. We can and have borrowed from abroad to finance our national investment at a cost. Nobody lends money for nothing. Borrowing from abroad means that we must pay some of our investment returns to our foreign lenders. Any country with significant exposure to foreign lenders must always worry that when times get tough, the herd of international investors will get spooked and flee with their capital. Demographics. Americans are getting older, literally. As economist Paul Krugman has noted, the age distribution in America will eventually begin to look as it does in Florida. That's good for the companies that manufacture shuffleboard equipment. It's not so good for government finances. The bulk of government benefits, notably Social Security and Medicare, are bestowed on Americans who are retired. These programs are financed with payroll taxes imposed on younger Americans who are still working. If the ratio of young Americans to older Americans begins to change, then the financial health of programs like Social Security and Medicare begins to change too. Indeed, we can explain the importance of demographics and fix Social Security all in the next two paragraphs. Social Security is a pay-as-you-go program. When American workers pay into Social Security, that large FICA deduction on your paycheck, the money doesn't get invested somewhere so that you can draw on it 20 or 30 years later, as it would in a private pension fund. Rather, that money is used to pay current retirees. Straight from young Peter to old Paul. The program is one big pyramid scheme. And like any good pyramid scheme, it works fine as long as there are enough workers on the bottom to continue paying the retirees at the top. Therein lies the problem. Americans are having fewer children and living longer. This shift means that there are fewer workers to pay for every retiree. A lot fewer. In 1960, there were 5 workers for every retiree. Now, there are 3 workers for every retiree. By 2032, there will be only 2. Imagine Social Security or Medicare as a seesaw, in which payments made by workers are on one side and benefits collected by retirees are on the other. The program is solvent as long as the seesaw balances. As the number of workers on one side shrinks, while the number of retirees on the other side grows, the seesaw begins to tip. In theory, fixing the problem is easy. We can take more from current workers, either by increasing the payroll tax or by making them more productive and raising their incomes, so that the same tax generates more revenues. Or we can give less to retirees, either by cutting their benefits or by raising the retirement age. That is the very simple economic crux of the problem. Of course, if you think any of these solutions would be politically palatable, please go back and read Chapter 8 again. Total National Happiness. You decide. We don't have a number for that one yet. An auto worker in Detroit, who has spent his career getting laid off for months at a time and then called back to work, is going to ask a simple question. Are we getting any better at all this? Yes, we are. The United States has gone through 11 recessions since World War II. None, including the recession that began in 2007, is even of the same order of magnitude as the Great Depression. From 1929 to 1933, real GDP fell by 30%, while unemployment climbed from 3% to 25%. Prior to the Great Depression, the United States regularly experienced deep recessions, including financial panic, far worse than what we're going through now. We haven't made the economic bumps go away, but they are smaller bumps. One can also argue that what we've learned from past economic downturns, and the Great Depression in particular, has helped with policies this time around. Fed Chairman and former Princeton professor Ben Bernanke is a scholar of the Great Depression. So is Obama's chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, and former UC Berkeley professor Christina Romer. I can promise you that economists will still be arguing 50 years from now about what should or shouldn't have been done in response to the recession and subsequent financial crisis. However, even the toughest critics should concede that officials at the end of the Bush administration and the beginning of the Obama administration avoided the worst mistakes of the 1930s, when the Federal Reserve raised interest rates in the face of the Great Depression and Congress raised taxes, thrusting both monetary and fiscal policy in the wrong direction. There's something to be said for not doing exactly the wrong thing. I suspect history will judge that policymakers did even better than that. Chapter 10. The Federal Reserve. Why that dollar in your pocket is more than just a piece of paper. Sometimes, simple statements speak loudly. On September 11, 2001, hours after the terrorist attacks on the United States, the Federal Reserve issued the following statement. The Federal Reserve System is open and operating. The discount window is available to meet liquidity needs. Those terse and technical two sentences had a calming effect on global markets. The following Monday, as America's markets opened for their first trading sessions after the attack, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by 0.5%. Another act that moderated the financial and economic impact of the terrorist assaults. How exactly does an inelegant two-sentence statement have such a profound effect on the world's largest economy? Indeed, on the whole global economy. The Federal Reserve has tools with more direct impact on the global economy than any other institution in the world, public or private. During the economic crisis that began to unfold in 2007, the Federal Reserve used everything in that toolkit and then acquired some new gadgets to wrestle the financial system back from the brink of panic. Since then, some have criticized the Fed and its chairman, Ben Bernanke, for doing too much. Some have criticized the Fed for doing too little. Everyone agrees that what the Fed does matters enormously. From where does the Federal Reserve, an institution that is not directly accountable to the voting public, derive such power? And how does that power affect the lives of everyday Americans? The answer to all those questions is the same. The Federal Reserve controls the money supply and therefore the credit tap for the economy. When that tap is open wide, interest rates fall and we spend more freely on things that require borrowed money. Everything from new cars to new manufacturing plants. Thus, the Fed can use monetary policy to counteract economic downturns or prevent them in the first place. And it can inject money into the financial system after sudden shocks. such as the 1987 stock market crash, or the terrorist attacks of September 11th, or the bursting of the American real estate bubble, when consumers and firms might otherwise freeze in place and stop spending. Or the Fed can tighten the tap by raising interest rates. When the cost of borrowed funds goes up, our spending slows. It is an awesome power. Paul Krugman once wrote, "If you want a simple model for predicting the unemployment rate in the United States over the next few years, here it is. It will be what Greenspan wants it to be, plus or minus a random error reflecting the fact that he is not quite God." The same is now true of Ben Bernanke. God does not have to manage by committee. Ben Bernanke does. The Federal Reserve System is made up of 12 reserve banks spread across the country and a 7-person board of governors based in Washington. Ben Bernanke is chairman of the board of governors. He's the Fed chairman. The Federal Reserve regulates commercial banks, supports the banking infrastructure, and generally makes the plumbing of the financial system work. Those jobs require competence, not genius or great foresight. Monetary policy, the Federal Reserve's other responsibility, is different. It might reasonably be described as the economic equivalent of brain surgery. Economists do not agree on how the Federal Reserve ought to manage our money supply. Nor do they even agree on exactly how or why changes in the money supply have the effects that they do. Yet economists do agree that effective monetary policy matters. The Fed must feed just the right amount of credit to the economy to keep it growing steadily. Getting it wrong can have disastrous consequences. Robert Mundell, winner of the 1999 Nobel Prize in Economics, has argued that bungled monetary policy in the 1920s and 1930s caused chronic deflation that destabilized the world. He has argued, had the price of gold been raised in the late 1920s, or alternatively, had the major central banks pursued policies of price stability instead of adhering to the gold standard, there would have been no Great Depression, no Nazi Revolution, and no World War II. The job would not appear to be that complicated. If the Fed can make the economy grow faster by lowering interest rates, then presumably lower interest rates are always better. Indeed, why should there be any limit to the rate at which the economy can grow? If we begin to spend more freely, when rates are cut from 7% to 5%, why stop there? If there are still people without jobs and others without new cars, then let's press on to 3%, or even 1%. New money for everyone. Sadly, there are limits to how fast an economy can grow. If low interest rates or easy money causes consumers to demand 5% more new PT Cruisers than they purchased last year, then Chrysler must expand production by 5%. That means hiring more workers and buying more steel, glass, electrical components, etc. At some point, it becomes difficult or impossible for Chrysler to find these new inputs, particularly qualified workers. At that point, the company simply cannot make enough PT Cruisers to satisfy consumer demand. Instead, the company begins to raise prices. Meanwhile, auto workers recognize that Chrysler is desperate for labor, and the union demands higher wages. The story doesn't stop there. The same thing would be happening throughout the economy, not just at Chrysler. If interest rates are exceptionally low, firms will borrow to invest in new computer systems and software. Consumers will break out their Visa cards for big-screen televisions and Caribbean cruises, all up to a point. When the cruise ships are full and Dell is selling every computer it can produce, then those firms will raise their prices too. When demand exceeds supply, firms can charge more and still fill every boat or sell every computer. In short, an easy money policy at the Fed can cause consumers to demand more than the economy can produce. The only way to ration that excess demand is with higher prices. The result is inflation. The sticker price on the PT Cruiser goes up, and no one is better off for it. True, Chrysler is taking in more money, but it's also paying more to its suppliers and workers. Those workers are seeing higher wages, but they're also paying higher prices for their basic needs. Numbers are changing everywhere, but the productive capacity of our economy and the measure of our well-being, real GDP, has hit the wall. Once started, the inflationary cycle is hard to break. Firms and workers everywhere begin to expect continually rising prices, which in turn causes continually rising prices. Welcome to the 1970s. The pace at which the economy can grow without causing inflation might reasonably be considered a speed limit. After all, there are only a handful of ways to increase the amount that we as a nation can produce. We can work longer hours. We can add new workers through falling unemployment or immigration, recognizing that the workers available may not have the skills in demand. We can add machines and other kinds of capital that help us to produce things. Or we can become more productive, produce more with what we already have, perhaps because of an innovation or a technological change. Each of these sources of growth has natural constraints. Workers are scarce. Capital is scarce. Technological change proceeds at a finite and unpredictable pace. In the late 1990s, American auto workers threatened to go on strike because they were being forced to work too much overtime. Don't we wish we had that problem now? Meanwhile, fast food restaurants were offering signing bonuses to new employees. We were at the wall. Economists reckon that the speed limit of the American economy is somewhere in the range of 3% growth per year. The phrase, somewhere in the range, gives you the first inkling of how hard the Fed's job is. The Federal Reserve must strike a delicate balance. If the economy grows more slowly than it's capable of, then we're wasting economic potential. Plants that make PT Cruisers sit idle. The workers who might have jobs there are unemployed instead. An economy that has the capacity to grow at 3% instead limps along at 1.5% or even slips into recession. Thus, the Fed must feed enough credit to the economy to create jobs and prosperity, but not so much that the economy begins to overheat. William McChesney Martin, Jr., Federal Reserve Chairman during the 1950s and 1960s, once noted that the Fed's job is to take away the punch bowl just as the party gets going. Or sometimes the Fed must rein in the party long after it's gone out of control. The Federal Reserve has deliberately engineered a number of recessions in order to squeeze inflation out of the system. Most notably, Fed Chairman Paul Volcker was the ogre who ended the inflationary party of the 1970s. At that point, naked people were dancing wildly on the tables. Inflation had climbed from 3% in 1972 to 13.5% in 1980. Mr. Volcker hit the monetary brakes, meaning that he cranked up interest rates to slow the economy down. Short-term interest rates peaked at over 16% in 1981. The result was a painful unwinding of the inflationary cycle. With interest rates in double digits, there were plenty of unsold Chrysler K cars sitting on the lot. Dealers were forced to cut prices or stop raising them. The auto companies idled plants and laid off workers. The auto workers, who still had jobs, decided that it would be a bad time to ask for more money. The same thing, of course, was going on in every other sector of the economy. Slowly, and at great human cost, the expectation that prices would steadily rise was purged from the system. The result was the recession of 1981-1982, during which GDP shrank by 3% and unemployment climbed to nearly 10%. In the end, Mr. Volcker did clear the dancers off the tables. By 1983, inflation had fallen to 3%. Obviously, it would have been easier and less painful if the party had never gone out of control in the first place. Where does the Fed derive this extraordinary power over interest rates? After all, commercial banks are private entities. The Federal Reserve cannot force Citibank to raise or lower the rates it charges consumers for auto loans and home mortgages. Rather, the process is indirect. Recall from Chapter 7 that the interest rate is really just a rental rate for capital, or the price of money. The Fed controls America's money supply. We'll get to the mechanics of that process in a moment. For now, recognize that capital is no different from apartments. The greater the supply, the cheaper the rent. The Fed moves interest rates by making changes in the quantity of funds available to commercial banks. If banks are awash with money, then interest rates must be relatively low to attract borrowers for all the available funds. When capital is scarce, the opposite will be true. Banks can charge higher interest rates and still attract enough borrowers for all available funds. It's supply and demand, with the Fed controlling the supply. These monetary decisions, the determination whether interest rates need to go up, down, or stay the same, are made by a committee within the Fed called the Federal Open Market Committee, or FOMC, which consists of the Board of Governors, the President of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and the presidents of four other Federal Reserve banks on a rotating basis. The Fed chairman's also the chairman of the FOMC. Ben Bernanke derives his power from the fact that he's sitting at the head of the table when the FOMC makes interest rate decisions. If the FOMC wants to stimulate the economy by lowering the cost of borrowing, the committee has two primary tools at its disposal. The first is the discount rate, which is the interest rate at which commercial banks can borrow funds directly from the Federal Reserve. The relationship between the discount rate and the cost of borrowing at Citibank is straightforward. When the discount rate falls, banks can borrow more cheaply from the Fed and therefore lend more cheaply to their customers. There's one complication. Borrowing directly from the Fed carries a certain stigma. It implies that a bank was not able to raise funds privately. Thus, turning to the Fed for a loan is similar to borrowing from your parents after about age 25. You'll get the money, but it's better to look somewhere else first. Instead, banks generally borrow from other banks. The second important tool in the Fed's money supply kit is the federal funds rate, the rate that banks charge other banks for short-term loans. The Fed cannot stipulate the rate at which Wells Fargo lends money to Citigroup. Rather, the FOMC sets a target for the federal funds rate, say 4.5%, and then manipulates the money supply to accomplish its objective. If the supply of funds goes up, then banks will have to drop their prices, lower interest rates, to find borrowers for the new funds. One can think of the money supply as a furnace, with the federal funds rate as its thermostat. If the FOMC cuts the target Fed funds rate from 4.5% to 4.25%, then the Federal Reserve will pump money into the banking system until the rate Wells Fargo charges Citigroup for an overnight loan falls to something very close to 4.25%. All of which brings us to our final conundrum. How does the Federal Reserve inject money into a private banking system? Does Ben Bernanke print $100 million of new money, load it into a heavily armored truck, and drive it to a Citibank branch? Not exactly, though that image is not a bad way to understand what does happen. Ben Bernanke and the FOMC do create new money. In the United States, they alone have that power. The Treasury merely mints new currency and coins to replace money that already exists. The Federal Reserve does deliver new money to banks like Citibank, but the Fed does not give funds to the bank. It trades the new money for government bonds that the banks currently own. In our metaphorical example, the Citibank branch manager meets Ben Bernanke's armored truck outside the bank, loads $100 million of new money into the bank's vault, and then hands the Fed chairman $100 million in government bonds from the bank's portfolio in return. Note that Citibank has not been made richer by the transaction. The bank has merely swapped $100 million of one kind of asset, bonds, for $100 million of a different kind of asset, cash, or more accurately, its electronic equivalent. Banks hold bonds for the same reason individual investors do. Bonds are a safe place to park funds that aren't needed for something else. Specifically, banks buy bonds with depositors' funds that are not being loaned out. To the economy, the fact that Citibank has swapped bonds for cash makes all the difference. When a bank has $100 million of deposits parked in bonds, those funds are not being loaned out. They're not financing houses or businesses or new plants. But after Ben Bernanke's metaphorical armored truck pulls away, Citibank is left holding funds that can be loaned out. This means new loans for all kinds of things that generate economic activity. Indeed, money injected into the banking system has a cascading effect. A bank that swaps bonds for money from the Fed keeps some fraction of the funds in reserves, as required by law, and then loans out the rest. Whoever receives those loans will spend them somewhere, perhaps at a car dealership or a department store. That money eventually ends up in other banks, which will keep some funds in reserve and then make loans of their own. A move by the Fed to inject $100 million of new funds into the banking system may ultimately increase the money supply by 10 times as much. Of course, the Fed chairman doesn't actually drive a truck to a Citibank branch to swap cash for bonds. The FOMC can accomplish the same thing using the bond market, which works just like the stock market, except that bonds are bought and sold. Bond traders working on behalf of the Fed buy bonds from commercial banks and pay for them with newly created money, funds that simply did not exist 20 minutes earlier. Presumably, the banks selling their bonds will be those with the most opportunities to make new loans. The Fed will continue to buy bonds with new money, a process called open market operations, until the target federal funds rate has been reached. Obviously, what the Fed giveth, the Fed can take away. The Federal Reserve can raise interest rates by doing the opposite of everything we've just discussed. The FOMC would vote to raise the discount rate and/or the target Fed funds rate and issue an order to sell bonds from its portfolio to commercial banks. As banks give up lendable funds in exchange for bonds, the money supply shrinks. Money that might have been loaned out to consumers and businesses is parked in bonds instead. Interest rates go up, and anything purchased with borrowed capital becomes more expensive. The cumulative effect is slower economic growth. The mechanics of the Fed's handiwork should not obscure the big picture. The Federal Reserve's mandate is to facilitate a sustainable pace of economic growth. But let's clarify how difficult that job really is. First, we're only guessing at the rate at which the economy can expand without igniting inflation. One debate among economists is over whether or not computers and other kinds of information technology have made Americans significantly more productive. If so, as Mr. Greenspan suggested during his tenure, then the economy's potential growth rate may have gone up. If not, as other economists have argued convincingly, then the old speed limit still applies. Obviously, it's hard to abide by a speed limit that is not clearly posted. But that's only the first challenge. The Fed must also reckon what kind of impact a change in interest rates will have and how long it'll take. Will a quarter-point rate cut cause 12 people to buy new PT Cruisers in Des Moines, or 421? When? Next week? Or 6 months from now? Meanwhile, the Fed has the most control over short-term interest rates, which may or may not move in the same direction as long-term rates. Why can't Ben Bernanke work his magic on long-term rates, too? Because long-term rates do not depend on the money supply today. They depend on what the markets predict money supply, relative to demand, will be 10, 20, or even 30 years from now. Ben Bernanke has no control over the money supply in 2015. Also remember that while the Fed's trying to use monetary policy to hit a particular economic target, Congress may be doing things with fiscal policy, government decisions on taxes and spending, that have a different effect entirely, or have the same effect, causing Fed policy to overshoot. So let's stick with our speed limit analogy and recap what exactly the Fed is charged with doing. The Fed must facilitate a rate of economic growth that is neither too fast nor too slow. Bear in mind, 1. We do not know the economy's exact speed limit. 2. Both the accelerator and the brake operate with a lag, meaning that neither works immediately when we press on it. Instead, we have to wait a while for a response, anywhere from a few weeks to a few years, but not with any predictable pattern. An inexperienced driver might press progressively harder on the gas, wondering why nothing is happening, and enduring all kinds of public assaults on his pathetically slow driving, only to find the car screaming out of control 9 months later. 3. Monetary and fiscal policy affect the economy independently. So while the Fed is gently applying the brake, Congress and the President may be jumping up and down on the accelerator. Or the Fed may tap on the accelerator ever so slightly, only to have Congress weigh it down with a brick. 4. Last, there's the obstacle course of world events. A financial collapse here, a spike in the price of oil there. Think of the Fed as always driving in unfamiliar terrain, with a map that's at least 10 years out of date. Bob Woodward's biography of Alan Greenspan was titled Maestro. In the 1990s, as the American economy roared through its longest expansion in economic history, Mr. Greenspan was given credit for his Goldilocks approach to monetary policy, doing everything just right. That reputation has since come partially unraveled. Mr. Greenspan is now criticized for abetting the housing and stock market bubbles by keeping interest rates too low for too long. Cheap money didn't cause inflation by sending everyone to buy PT Cruisers and Caribbean Cruises. Instead, we bought stocks and real estate, and those rising asset prices didn't show up in the Consumer Price Index. Add one new challenge to monetary policy. We were speeding, even though the gauges we're used to looking at said we weren't. It's a hard job. Still, that conclusion is a long way from Nobel laureate Robert Mundell's dire claim that bad monetary policy laid the groundwork for World War II. To understand why irresponsible monetary policy can have cataclysmic effects, we must first make a short digression on the nature of money. To economists, money is quite distinct from wealth. Wealth consists of all things that have value: houses, cars, commodities, human capital. Money, a tiny subset of that wealth, is merely a medium of exchange, something that facilitates trade and commerce. In theory, money is not even necessary. A simple economy could get along through barter alone. In a basic agricultural society, it's easy enough to swap 5 chickens for a new dress, or to pay a school teacher with a goat and 3 sacks of rice. Barter works less well in a more advanced economy. The logistical challenges of using chickens to buy books at Amazon would be formidable. In nearly every society, some kind of money has evolved to make trade easier. The word salary comes from the wages paid to Roman soldiers, who were paid in sacks of sal, or salt. Any medium of exchange, whether it's a gold coin, a whale tooth, or an American dollar, serves the same basic purposes. First, it serves as a means of exchange, so that I might enjoy pork chops for dinner tonight, even though the butcher has no interest in buying this book. Second, it serves as a unit of account, so that the cost of all kinds of goods and services can be measured and compared using one scale. Imagine life without a unit of account. The Gap is selling jeans for 3 chickens a pair, while Tommy Hilfiger has similar pants on sale for 11 beaver pelts. Which pants cost more? Third, money must be portable and durable. Neither bowling balls nor rose petals would serve the purpose. Last, money must be relatively scarce so that it can serve as a store of value. Clever people will always find a medium of exchange that works. Cigarettes long served as the medium of exchange in prisons where cash is banned. It doesn't matter whether you smoke. Cigarettes have value as long as enough other inmates smoke. So what happened when smoking was banned in U.S. federal prisons? Inmates turned to another portable, durable store of value, cans of mackerel. According to the Wall Street Journal, a single can of mackerel, or the Mac, is the standard unit of currency behind bars. Some prisons have moved from cans to plastic pouches because the cans can be fashioned into weapons. In a can or pouch, mackerel doesn't spoil. It can be bought on account in the commissary, and it costs about a dollar, making the accounting easy. A haircut costs 2 Macs in the Lompoc Federal Correctional Complex. For much of American history, commerce was conducted with paper currency backed by precious metals. Prior to the 20th century, private banks issued their own money. In 1913, the U.S. government banned private money and became the sole provider of currency. The basic idea didn't change. Whether money was public or private, paper currency derived its value from the fact that it could be redeemed for a set quantity of gold or silver, either from a bank or from the government. Then, something strange happened. In 1971, the United States permanently went off the gold standard. At that point, every paper dollar became redeemable for nothing. Examine that wad of $100 bills in your wallet. If necessary, $1 bills can be substituted instead. Those bills are just paper. You can't eat them, you can't drink them, you can't smoke them, and most important, you can't take them to the government and demand anything in return. They have no intrinsic value. And that's true of nearly all the world's currencies. Left alone on a deserted island with $100 million, you would quickly perish. On the other hand, life would be good if you were rescued and could take the cash with you. Therein lies the value of modern currency. It has purchasing power. Dollars have value because people peddling real things, food, books, pedicures, will accept them. And people peddling real things will accept dollars because they're confident that other people peddling other real things will accept them too. A dollar is a piece of paper whose value derives solely from our confidence that we'll be able to use it to buy something we need in the future. To give you some sense of how modern money's a confidence game, consider a bizarre phenomenon in India. Most Indians involved in commerce, shopkeepers, taxi drivers, etc., will not accept a torn, crumpled, or overly soiled rupee note. Since other Indians know that many of their countrymen will not accept torn notes, they will not accept them either. Finally, when tourists arrive in the country, they quickly learn to accept only intact bills, lest they be stuck with the torn ones. The whole process is utterly irrational, since the Indian Central Bank considers any note with a serial number torn, dirty, crumpled, or otherwise, to be legal tender. Any bank will exchange torn rupees for crisp new ones. That doesn't matter. Rational people refuse legal tender because they believe that it might not be accepted by someone else. The whole bizarre phenomenon underscores the fact that our faith in paper currency is predicated on the faith that others place in the same paper. Since paper currency has no inherent worth, its value depends on its purchasing power. Something that can change gradually over time, or even stunningly fast. In the summer of 1997, I spent a few days driving across Iowa, taking the pulse of the American farmer for The Economist. Somewhere outside of Des Moines, I began chatting with a corn, soybean, and cattle farmer. As he gave me a tour of his farm, he pointed to an old tractor parked outside the barn. "That tractor cost $7,500 new in 1970, he said. "Now look at this," he said angrily, pointing to a shiny new tractor right next to the old one. "Cost me $40,000. Can you explain that?" I can't remember the exact numbers, but they were something along these lines. I could explain that, though that's not what I told the farmer, who was already suspicious of the fact that I was young, from the city, wearing a tie, and driving a Honda Civic. The following year, when I was asked to write a similar story on Kentucky tobacco farmers, I had the good sense to rent a pickup truck. My answer would have been one word: inflation. The new tractor probably wasn't any more expensive than the old tractor in real terms, meaning that he had to do the same amount of work or less in order to buy it. The sticker price on his tractor had gone up, but so had the prices at which he could sell his crops and cattle. Inflation means, quite simply, that average prices are rising. The inflation rate, or the change in the consumer price index, is the government's attempt to reflect changing prices with a single number, say 4.2%. The method of determining this figure is surprisingly low-tech. Government officials periodically check the prices of thousands and thousands of goods: clothes, food, fuel, entertainment, housing, and then compile them into a number that reflects how the prices of a basket of goods purchased by the average consumer has changed. The most instructive way to think about inflation is not that prices are going up, but rather that the purchasing power of the dollar is going down. A dollar buys less than it used to. Therein lies the link between the Federal Reserve, or any central bank, and economic devastation. A paper currency has value only because it is scarce. The central bank controls that scarcity. Therefore, a corrupt or incompetent central bank can erode or even completely destroy the value of our money. Suppose prison officials, in a fit of goodwill, decided to give every inmate 500 cans of mackerel. What would happen to the price of a prison haircut in Macs? And mackerel's better than paper, in that it at least has some intrinsic value. In 1921, a German newspaper cost roughly a third of a mark. 2 years later, a newspaper cost 70 million marks. It wasn't the newspaper that changed during that spell. It was the German mark, which was rendered useless as the government printed new ones with reckless abandon. Indeed, the mark lost so much value that it became cheaper for households to burn them than to use them to buy firewood. Inflation was so bad in Latin America in the 1980s that there were countries whose largest import became paper currency. In the late 1990s, the Belarusian ruble was known as the bunny, not only for the hair engraved on the note, but also for the currency's remarkable ability to propagate. In August 1998, the Belarusian ruble lost 10% of its purchasing power in 1 week. Massive inflation distorts the economy massively. Workers rush to spend their cash before it becomes worthless. A culture emerges in which workers rush out to spend their paychecks at lunch because prices will have gone up by dinner. Fixed-rate loans become impossible because no financial institution will agree to be repaid a fixed quantity of money when that money is at risk of becoming worthless. Think about it. Anyone with a fixed-rate mortgage in Germany in 1921 could have paid off the whole loan in 1923 with fewer marks than it cost to buy a newspaper. Even today, it's not possible to get a 30-year fixed mortgage in much of Latin America because of fears that inflation will come roaring back. America has never suffered hyperinflation. We've had bouts of moderate inflation. The costs were smaller and more subtle, but still significant. At the most basic level, inflation leads to misleading or inaccurate comparisons. Journalists rarely distinguish between real and nominal figures, as they ought to. Suppose that American incomes rose 5% last year. That's a meaningless figure until we know the inflation rate. If prices rose by 7%, then we've actually become worse off. Our paycheck may look bigger, but it buys 2% fewer goods than it did last year. Hollywood is an egregious offender, proclaiming summer after summer that some mediocre film has set a new box office record. Comparing gross receipts in 2010 to gross receipts in 1970 or 1950 is a silly exercise unless they're adjusted for inflation. A ticket to Gone with the Wind cost 19 cents. A ticket to Dude, Where's My Car cost $10. Of course the gross receipts are going to look big by comparison. Even moderate inflation has the potential to eat away at our wealth if we do not manage our assets properly. Any wealth held in cash will lose value over time. Even savings accounts and certificates of deposit, which are considered safe investments because the principal is insured, are vulnerable to the less obvious risk that their low interest rates may not keep up with inflation. It's a sad irony that unsophisticated investors eschew the risky stock market only to have their principal whittled away through the back door. Inflation can be particularly pernicious for individuals who are retired or otherwise living on fixed incomes. If that income is not indexed for inflation, then its purchasing power will gradually fade away. A monthly check that made for a comfortable living in 1985 becomes inadequate to buy the basic necessities in 2010. Inflation also redistributes wealth arbitrarily. Suppose I borrow $1,000 from you and promise to pay back the loan plus interest of $100 next year. That seems a fair arrangement for both of us. Now, suppose that a wildly irresponsible central banker allows inflation to explode to 100% a year. That $1,100 that I paid back to you next year will be worth much less than either of us had expected. Its purchasing power will be cut in half. In real terms, I'll borrow $1,100 from you and pay back $550. Unexpected bouts of inflation are good for debtors and bad for lenders, a crucial point that we'll come back to. As a side note, you should recognize the difference between real and nominal interest rates. The nominal rate is used to calculate what you have to pay back. It's the number you see posted on the bank window or on the front page of a loan document. If Wells Fargo's paying a rate of 2.3% on checking deposits, that's the nominal rate. This rate is different from the real interest rate, which takes inflation into account and therefore reflects the true cost of renting capital. The real interest rate is the nominal rate minus the rate of inflation. As a simple example, suppose you take out a bank loan for 1 year at a nominal rate of 5%, and that inflation is also 5% that year. In such a case, your real rate of interest is zero. You pay back 5% more than you borrowed, but the value of that money has depreciated 5% over the course of the year. So what you pay back has exactly the same purchasing power as what you borrowed. The true cost to you of using someone else's capital for a year is zero. Inflation also distorts taxes. Take the capital gains tax, for example. Suppose you buy a stock and sell it a year later, earning a 10% return. If the inflation rate was also 10% over that period, then you have not actually made any money.